This message comes from the preaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
An article in The Atlantic magazine a few years ago revealed how much has changed in our world over the last 100 years. And it really talks about how the human heart, how men and women haven't really changed at all, fundamentally. In fact, things once considered luxuries are now considered necessities. To illustrate, the magazine pointed out this article that in the year 1900, 90% of our country's households did not have electricity or a telephone. In 1915, 90% of the families in our country did not own an automobile. In 1930, 90% did not own a refrigerator or a washing machine. In 1945, 90% didn't have air conditioning. I remember 1965, our family didn't have it either. You're probably like that if you're as old as I am. In 1960, 90% didn't own a dishwasher or color TV. In 1975, 90% didn't own a microwave. In 1990, 90% of the people in our country didn't own a cell phone or have the internet. I mean, how do you survive today, right? The article went on to write, at least today, now 90% of our country does have electricity, a stove, a washing machine, an automobile, color TVs, air conditioning, dishwashers, internet, and cell phones. And now we know it isn't enough. It isn't enough. You add to the discontent in our world around us the fact that experiences are also weighed differently in our generation. A New York Times article wrote that most people cannot be satisfied anymore with normal, anything normal in life. The author wrote that every meal you have out has to be extraordinary. Every friendship has to be fulfilling. Every concert you hear has to be superb. Every sunset, celestial. Every movie has to be a stunning epic. Nothing can be normal. Christian author Michael Horton responded to that Times article by adding, your marriage has to be made in heaven, even though you're living on earth and made of earth. Your kids have to make the dean's list and study in the best schools. Your past work experience needs to be brilliant or groundbreaking if you ever hope to get ahead. And if you ever do stop long enough to take a vacation, it needs to be an unforgettable package at an amazing resort with nonstop fun for the whole family. Or we're not interested. The truth is, we just can't get enough. Dennis Johnson wrote rather tongue-in-cheek that the economic health of our country depends on the cultivation of discontent. Now, the problem didn't start with us. It didn't start in our generation. It didn't start in our country, and it didn't start in the 1900s. And it hadn't necessarily gotten any worse. In fact, it began at the beginning of human history. Adam and Eve lived in what we would all agree was an amazing paradise, a world of innocence and beauty and harmony. They had everything they needed until Satan came along, who, by the way, wasn't satisfied either, and began to sow the seeds, this cultivation of discontent. What was it that drew Adam and Eve's hearts away from God? What was it that successfully seduced them into rebellion and unbelief? Simply put, they wanted more. They wanted something more. And Satan, who didn't have enough, simply came along and convinced their eager hearts that what they had was not enough. Jason Lehman expresses the discontent in our own hearts when he penned this poem. It was spring, but it was summer I wanted. The warm days and the great outdoors. It was summer, but it was autumn I wanted. Boy, don't you find yourself in there? I sure do. The colorful leaves and the cool, dry air. It was autumn, but it was winter I wanted, the beautiful snow and the joy of the holiday season. It was winter, but it was spring I wanted, the warmth and the blossoming of nature. I was a child, but it was adulthood I wanted, the freedom and the respect. I was 20, but it was 30 that I wanted, to be mature and sophisticated. I was middle-aged, and it was 20 I wanted, the youth, the free spirit. Then I retired, and it was middle age I wanted, the presence of mind without limitations. My life is now nearing the end, and I never got what I wanted. Thomas Watson, the Puritan pastor of 350 years ago, wrote that discontent dislocates the soul, it dries the brain, it corrodes the comfort of life, and it wastes the spirit away. In his very personal letter to his beloved friends and old apostle, who doesn't really have very long before he nears the end of his life, as he is indeed when he writes it, he speaks to this subject of contentment. He even informs them that he has found the secret to overcoming this easily cultivated discontent. So take your copy of the New Testament and turn to his letter again, Philippians chapter 4, and where we left off in our last study at verse 10. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 10. Now let me just kind of read the paragraph and then we'll go and sort of pick it apart, okay? Paul writes, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, and now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction." Now, what I want to do is go and pull from this text four words by way of observation and give four principles that Paul lays out here, if we could summarize it, that capture this challenging, this rather elusive, this godly, this mature virtue called contentment. That is so slippery, isn't it? The first word is gratitude. And the first principle is this: appreciate whatever you have. Appreciate whatever you have. Now, Paul has already told the Philippians, if you go back up to verse 4, he's commanded them in this series of imperatives to rejoice in the Lord, and again I say rejoice. Not optional, not incidental, it's intentional. Now, down at verse 10, you're going to watch him practice what he preaches. Notice again at verse 10, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly." And maybe you would wonder, what in the world does Paul have to rejoice greatly over? He's chained to a praetorian guard on either side of him. He's under house arrest. He's eating a rationed, meager diet. He's without many friends. The church in Rome has effectively abandoned him. And he writes, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly." Why? Well, because Paul is focusing, as we'll learn, on what he has, not what he lacks. And what does he have? Notice further. "At last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity." In our next session, I want to explore their support as a church for Paul a little more carefully because of what it will teach us. But for now, you need to know that Epaphroditus has arrived in Rome with a financial gift to meet Paul's needs. Prisoners in this day, under house arrest, and even those imprisoned, had to have their relatives or friends provide their food and the things they would need. So Epaphroditus arrives with a little money for Paul's needs, and Paul rejoices over this gift. But he's rejoicing more than that over what it represented in their care for him. Paul actually describes their concern here with a word translated revived. Notice, you have revived your concern for me. The word for revived refers to flowers blooming again. In other words, to Paul, their gift was like a fresh bouquet of blooming flowers that were blossoming in all their beauty. And Paul begins to greatly rejoice in the Lord, because for Paul, here in these, you know, rented quarters where he's under house arrest, he's saying that your gift has effectively turned this room into a garden in full bloom. I couldn't help but think that Adam and Eve lived in a garden, and it wasn't enough, and Paul is living in chains, and it has become to him a garden. This is a contented man. He says, now you lacked opportunity to help earlier. And by the way, he doesn't mention why they lacked opportunity. If you go over to 2 Corinthians in chapter 8, it's possible that they were having their own severe trials. They were impoverished. It could have been that Paul's imprisonment in Rome made him inaccessible to the Philippians. It could have been that the Roman believers weren't helping them in what they wanted to do. We're not told. But it occurred to me that it very well might be, just knowing Paul as we're coming to know him, that Paul is simply choosing to write the best and to think the best of them, as if to write here, I know you would have sent help earlier, but I'm sure it wasn't possible. I'm sure you didn't have an opportunity, but that's okay. Think of what he could have written. He could have majored on his suffering and the silence and the lack of support and the abandonment of the church and his personal deprivation and his long, long wait for a word or help from them. He could have begun at verse 10 to write something more like this. It's about time. It's about time. I would have written something like that. The person with a discontented heart is usually convinced that everything he does for God is way over the top and that everything that God does for him is too little and usually too late. Paul has every reason to believe all of that. But you watch him here demonstrating contentment by choosing to rejoice in whatever he has. That's gratitude. The second word that comes to my mind as I study this with you is the word responsibility. And here's the principle. Not only should we appreciate whatever we have, we should apply whatever we learn. We should apply whatever we learn. Look at verse 11. Not that I speak from want, that is, or need, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I have learned to be content. The verb Paul uses informs us that he has learned it by means of personal experience over time. Which means that Paul had to apply God's truth that he learned to whatever he experienced in his life. Which means that Paul did not reach contentment automatically. Which means we don't automatically become contented in our lives just because we've been saved. Which means that if Paul had to learn contentment, so do we. For Paul, it grew over a lifetime, as he faced one adverse situation after another in finances and health and relationships, he's learning to apply the truth of who God was and what God said, no matter what he faced. He learned to grip, as it were, tightly, not his expectations of what ought to happen, but gripping tightly to the grace of God in the midst of whatever happened. In fact, the word Paul uses here for content, I have learned to be content, is a Greek word that refers to someone, now follow this, someone whose resources are within him so that he doesn't depend on substitutes around him. Let me say that again. A contented person is someone whose resources are within him so that he doesn't have to depend on substitutes around him. In other words, Your contentment cannot be created by your salary package. Your contentment cannot be created by a title or relationships or health or popularity. It doesn't hang on your retirement plan or the fact that you've got kids who are smarter than others, or you got a big garage or a well-stocked tool shed. Those are externals. Those are substitutes. And they haven't produced any more contentment in families today who didn't have a washing machine or an automobile or a cell phone than those families in 1900 that had none of it. Those are externals, and they come and go like the ocean's tide. Christ-centered contentment, one author wrote on this text, is not pre-installed in our hearts like a software program that's preloaded into that new computer you buy. No, no, no. You have to add it to the computer. You add it to your life. That's your responsibility. In fact, the Apostle Peter writes along these lines as he encourages the believer to apply all diligence and add to your faith moral excellence. Pursue it. Add to moral excellence knowledge. Add to knowledge self-control. Add to self-control perseverance. And on and on and on. 1 Peter chapter 1. These are things we learn and by the Spirit of God and the grace of God apply to our lives, taking on the full responsibility to refuse to excuse ourselves when we don't. Now keep in mind that the idea of learning, when Paul says, I learned, we have to rewrite a little bit of this term in our minds. And in biblical terminology, learning is never related to simply learning the truth, but in applying the truth. Learning in biblical terms is translating knowledge into wise living. That's why in biblical terms, the opposite of wisdom is not stupidity. The opposite of wisdom is disobedience. Refusing to apply what you're in the process of learning in a very real sense, it's dangerous to learn one more thing from the Bible unless we're willing to apply it. This is something then, according to Paul's own testimony, that he's learning over a lifetime of practice. And that's our responsibility to practice it as well. Let's make sure we're doing the homework. Let's make sure we're not skirting the assignments. Let's make sure we're getting the lessons right. One pastor wrote recently that he was wanting to teach his children contentment and also financial stewardship, and so he taught them the envelope system. And maybe some of you do it as well. When he said we gave them their allowance, they would put into envelopes marked give some of the money and save some of the money and spend for the money they would spend. He writes, I thought I was teaching them that life was more than money. I thought they were getting the lesson until one afternoon I came home from work and I had a Band-Aid on my arm. My daughter, who's a bright second grader, asked me, Daddy, why do you have that Band-Aid on your arm? I didn't want to alarm her, but I thought she was certainly old enough to get an explanation. So I told her that I'd gotten a medical exam that day so that I could buy a life insurance policy. She asked, what's a life insurance policy? I explained, well, Daddy loves you so much and loves our children and Mommy so much that if anything were to happen to me, it would provide immediately $250,000. Her eyes got really wide. I knew she was worried, but then she looked up at me and asked, a piece? Ruin that lesson. Let's get to it, Dad. Here's the lesson about contentment. It isn't a gift. It's something to be learned. It's an assignment. It's something you fight for as you wage war against the temptation to reach for that one more thing. To compare your lives to another. To envy, to fixate on, one author says, the uncomfortable or the inconvenient or the wrong that surrounds you and done to you. Contentment is the art, another author writes, of keeping a light touch on what we're calling these external substitutes that cannot satisfy. If we apply Ephesians 1, it means that we keep a strong grip on the grace of God that has been lavished on every one of us already. And we know we have a grip when we're grateful for what we have and we're applying what we learn. Charles Spurgeon, whose Morning and Evening is an enjoyment to me and perhaps to many of you in your own devotional reading, when he got to this particular text, he wrote this: contentment is not something that may be exercised naturally, but a science that is acquired gradually. Brother and sister, hush that complaint, as natural as it is, and continue on as a diligent student in the college of contentment. Isn't that good? Stay in school. Practice the assignments of gratitude. Do the homework of responsibility. There's a third word that comes to my mind from this text, and it's the word acceptance. Not only should you appreciate whatever you have and apply whatever you learn, thirdly, accept wherever you are. Notice further in verse 12, he writes, I know how to get along with humble means. By the way, that refers to a humble status in society. It's the same word used of Christ, who became a servant. I know how to get along in a demeaning, you know, sort of bottom of the food chain status. I also know how to live in prosperity. This word means to literally overflow with things. We know he came from an extremely wealthy family. He was able to be tutored by Gamaliel, the leading scholar of his day in law. I know what it means to have everything. He says, notice, in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry. In other words, I know what it's like to be stuffed with food, and I know what it's like to be starving for food. Both of having abundance and suffering need. Now, he doesn't expand on this here, but I want to go to another letter just briefly. You don't have to turn there, and just give you a little bit of the details of his own personal testimony and the extremity of his circumstances. Just read his expanded journal in his testimony to the Corinthian believers, where he gives the details of hunger and thirst, being beaten and being homeless, treated, you could paraphrase it, as the scum of the earth. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Where we, Paul writes later, learn. He says, we as servants of God experienced afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonments, riots, sleepless nights, and hunger. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Still later, Paul writes, 5 times I received 40 lashes minus 1. 5 times his back was covered with permanent scars. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 time I was stoned with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I get that. 1's enough for me. How about you? He gets back on a boat. I would have avoided the harbor. 3 times shipwrecked, he writes, and a night and a day I was adrift at sea. A night and a day adrift at sea. On frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, in toil and hardship, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Who among us would like to live the life of the Apostle Paul? Paul, frankly, as you read the details of that kind of testimony, would be the last guy on the planet you would ever expect as an older man to have learned contentment. I mean, the average Christian, and I among them, would have resigned years ago, assuming that God was either angry or finished with me or upset or tired of me. It's one calamity after another. One heartache after another, one life-threatening episode after another, one sleepless night with an empty, growling stomach after another. I don't know if we'd even want to tag along with them. But all of that was considered by Paul to be externals. They did not rewrite the conviction of his internal acceptance. Paul had learned that the Christian life is not a series of accidents. It is a series of appointments. It is a series of assignments as the divine tutor desires to teach us contentment. One of the reasons I love reading Paul, over and above the fact that it is the Word of God to us, is his realism. He's both positive and realistic at the same time. In fact, look down at verse 14. Look there. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my glorious ministry. Oh. Nevertheless, you've done well to share with me in my affliction. That word refers to intense trouble, overpowering pressure. He was a realist. He didn't shy away from describing the challenges of the Christian experience. He writes to them, "Thank you for your gift. I'm rejoicing in God greatly, and man, am I under intense pressure." Don't you love hearing from someone who speaks with realism like that? He's already mentioned in his letters tears and at the same time his joy. How? How does he do that? By developing the practice over time of gratitude, accepting the responsibility to apply and acceptance with wherever God has placed them. Appreciating whatever you have, applying whatever you learn, accepting wherever you are. Fourthly, it would be the word dependence. Dependence. The principle is this: abandon to Christ whatever you do. Did you notice Paul added something in this text? Earlier he had simply said, "I have learned." But now he adds, "I have learned the secret." Paul actually uses a rare word here. It's found only here in the New Testament to depict this process of learning. The original word for secret was actually a common technical term taken from the Greek mystery religions, where they initiated someone into their religion by way of ritual. In fact, you could rather woodenly translate what he says here to read, "I have been initiated." I'm an initiate. I've been taken backstage, as it were, to be initiated in the truth of the gospel. And he uses a word that his world would readily relate to someone who's being taken behind closed doors and giving a better understanding of their religion. Now, don't misunderstand here. Paul isn't suggesting that growing in Christ means that you have to learn secret passwords and a secret handshake or wave and, you know, top secret stuff so you can really get in on the inside track of Christian growth. Now, what he is doing here is using a word to effectively say, here is the insight I have learned by being on the inside as an initiate. This is the secret I have learned to practice over all these years as an initiate in the gospel. And by the way, it's not a secret because I'm about to put it into print. I'm going to put it in black and white. It's for everyone, every believer. Here's the secret. Verse 13. I can do all things through Him, that is Christ, who strengthens me. There it is. That's the inside scoop for the growing disciple to learn contentment. Acquiesce to Christ. Abandon to Christ whatever you attempt to do. Now, this particular verse happens to be one of the most quoted, embroidered, calligraphied, needle-pointed, magnetized on your refrigerator, printed on your coffee cup verse in all the Bible. And most often it's taken out of context. Would you notice that Paul does not write here, I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. He doesn't write, I can do anything I want to do through Christ who strengthens me. Sink that putt, and get an A, and grow hair, whatever. Not what he says, is it? This is not the pop Christian motivational speaker who says, you can do anything you want to do if you put your mind to it. And by the way, pray while you're at it. Because you can do anything you really want to do if you believe in yourself and ask Jesus to help you do. One of the my favorite Hebrew words comes to mind. It's pronounced baloney, right? That works in a Disney movie. Just believe in yourself and you can do anything. That's a lie, by the way. I hope you parents are telling your kids, by the way, what you just heard was a lie. You can put your mind to something and come in last place. The problem is the church has baptized Disney into Christianity by saying, just believe in Jesus and you can do anything you want. No, you can't. That isn't what Paul is saying. This verse is the inside scoop on his learning curve. He isn't saying I can do anything. He isn't saying I can do everything. He's saying I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And what are those all things? Those all things he just described. I can suffer hardship and persevere. I can handle an overflowing cup with balance. I can hold the humblest, lowest status on the food chain without resentment. I can be stuffed with food and starving for food without bitterness. I can be content in all things. How? Through the strength of the indwelling Christ within me. I have learned to abandon to him everything I am and everything I do. And I find in him the strength because I can't without him endure all things. See, here's the promise. God is effectively promising to give us the strength to do whatever he wants us to do. So what is God asking you to do? Where has he placed you today? What challenges are you going to start facing tomorrow? They're already on your mind today. What heartaches did you carry in with you this morning? What pressures overwhelm you? What losses grieve your heart today? What promotion have you experienced? What abundance do you need to handle with humility and wisdom? God planned all of that. And he can empower you as you depend in your weakness upon his strength, in your inability, on his ability. Does this verse promise that Christians can do anything they want to do? No. Here's the secret. God promises that you can do everything he calls you to do as you depend on his indwelling person and power. I can do all things through Christ is really the same thing as saying, I can do nothing without Christ. That's the point he wants to make. Here's the inside scoop. Christ is on the inside of you. He indwells you. He can empower you as you abandon to him everything you are not and everything you cannot. For his strength can through you. Think of it this way. Use your imagination with me. I know it's Sunday, but use your imagination. Imagine if Albert Einstein inhabited me at this very moment. The first thing I would do is stop combing my hair. But I would be able to pass Algebra 1 like I really didn't. As a senior in high school. In fact, I would be able to go back to that class. I would love it. This would be so much fun to go back to that teacher, that pagan teacher, and put a equation on the board and say, now, work that one out and just smile. It'd be so much fun. If Picasso could move into my body and take over my hands, I would be able to paint something no one would be able to understand, but I'd still get $30 million for it. I mean, wouldn't that be great? $30 million. I'd love to do that. If Mozart could inhabit my body and take over my mind and my imagination and my hands, I could write and play his sonatas. I could write a symphony. Without him, I couldn't do any of it. If Michelangelo could move into my body, I would be able to take a block of marble and carve a masterpiece. The secret to contentment is not trying harder, but inviting Christ to take over. To take over your hands and your imagination and your mind and your heart and your life. He has given you himself, and you abandon to him. You acquiesce to him. Whatever you do, you accept wherever you are. You apply whatever you learn. You appreciate whatever you have. And Paul is moving us to recognize that in the end, we have him. I close with this. The great missionary explorer David Livingston, whose biography is worth reading, served in Africa from 1840 until his death in 1873. He was always eager to travel into the uncharted lands of especially Central Africa to preach the gospel. And on one occasion he arrived at the edge of a large territory that was ruled by a powerful tribal chieftain there in Central Africa. He would need this man's permission before he could move forward. And according to tradition, the chief with his entourage would come out and meet Livingston, and if all went well, Livingston would be free to travel. But an exchange would be made first. According to custom, the chief would come and inspect all of his belongings, and he would lay it all out for him, his clothing, his coins, his books, his watch. On this one occasion, he did all of that and laid out his watch and his books and his clothing and his goat, upon which he depended for milk because he struggled with intestinal problems that always flared up when he ever had to drink the local water. Had it all spread out, and to his dismay, the chief chose his goat. And then, as was custom, he gave to David Livingston something that belonged to him, and he handed him his stick. His stick. Livingston writes how disappointed he was. He didn't need a walking stick. It wasn't long before he was complaining to God about this tradition and this chief and this ridiculous, he said, and useless walking stick. What could he ever do with it compared to the goat, he wrote, that kept him well and his digestive system working properly? As they traveled along, one of the local men came to him and explained to him, "What you have been given is not an ordinary walking cane. It is the king's very own scepter. It is his scepter. And with it you will find entrance to every village in our country. The king has honored you greatly." And sure enough, Central Africa opened up to him, and following him would come other missionaries, and the gospel would reach that land. According to Paul, if I can take that illustration and bring it into here as we wrap this up, God has not given us a walking stick. In fact, he hasn't even given us a royal scepter. He has given us Himself. The King Himself resides in us. He will open every door He wishes. He will take us wherever He wants. It is ours to abandon to Him our inability to understand and our weakness to handle it, and exchange our inability for His power. And because of that, as we learn with Paul, we can reach those moments in our lives where we can say what Adam and Eve didn't, where we can say something that Christians throughout the ages have struggled to say. We can say, enough! Enough! We have in Christ enough. For just a moment, let's pause. If you know the Lord personally, you know as well as I do that the moment I mentioned the word contentment, that we were going to be addressed by the Word of God to a virtue that represents perhaps the greatest challenge in our walk, because it requires gratitude and responsibility and acceptance and abandon. So I really don't need to say anything more. Why don't you talk to the Lord ever so briefly about where His Spirit has touched through this text your heart. And while you're talking to your Lord, if you're here without Christ, He doesn't indwell you. He only indwells you when you ask by faith in Him alone. And maybe you know enough of the gospel to do that right now. Why wait? Why attempt to find any kind of meaning in substitutes? Join us in learning that He is enough. You have enrolled us, Father, in this college of contentment, and it is a difficult course. Probably made more difficult because we trust ourselves. We look to ourselves. We look to others. We look around. We compare. We covet. We're unsatisfied. And maybe if we just had one thing more. Thank You for the reminder as a body of believers, as we've been able to sing about Your grace and revel in Your grace, and now through this text, utterly and totally depend again upon Your grace. We thank You. Thank You that You indwell us, not because we deserve that, not because we've worked up to that, but because we have merited it now after 5 years or 10 years or 50. Because You have saved us by Your grace and forgiven us. And You do that daily. Thank You.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared but not changed or altered. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.